Well, today is Monday, May 5th, and I'm here with Russ Moody, and he's going to tell us a bit about his experiences at the Forest Products Lab. Maybe if we can start out with sort of pre-Forest Products Lab, what was your education and your background, and what brought you here?
Okay, I graduated from college in 1964, the University of Wisconsin-Platteville in engineering, and was married at the time. We had a daughter, and I was interested in graduate school, but I had a considerable debt after going through school, and we'd talked about it, and I'm originally from a small town, Belmont, about 60 miles southwest of here, and I had other job opportunities in, I guess, California and some other places, but I looked at the Forest Products Lab as one person that was hiring, and I came and I talked to somebody up here, and yeah, they were interested in hiring somebody with my background. I'm a structural engineer, and so I am because I had the opportunity to go to graduate school here, and it wasn't a total disruption as far as away from the family, my wife's parents and my parents. And so I decided, well, this, and I met people here, and it seemed like a great place. So I came to work here 2 weeks after I graduated from college. So this is the first full-time job I ever had. Mm-hmm. As it turned out, the only one.
Great. And did you have a specific interest in forest products before coming here?
I've always loved the woods, trees, and stuff like that. So I had a timber structures course at the University of Wisconsin-Platteville, and the instructor in that had a lot of experience in timber engineering, and so I guess it was encouraging talking to him. He knew of the Forest Products Lab, and we actually came here on a tour my senior year, but I'd already been hired by then, so I was already on this already been hired by the time I got here. And I went to work, to start with, I went to work in the packaging group. Mm-hmm. So I was there for, I think, 2 to 2.5 years, something like that, working with John Koning and Keith Kellicott, Bob Kurtnacker in the packaging area. And really enjoyed that. It was challenging, a lot of great people to work with. And then one day they came to me and said, Russ, we think we have a different position for you here, and that it would probably be they encouraged me to, really didn't give me much choice. I don't think they said this was it was working in the structural area, laminated products, and I'd be working in that area with, and I think Billy Bohannon was the head of that group at that time. So I went to work in that area, and that's really where I spent my entire career in that area. I worked as a research engineer, and then became the project leader, and then 10 years ago retired from that position as project leader.
Great. So prior to your interview here and being hired and then going on the tour and whatever, had you heard of the Forest Products Lab?
Probably not until the last semester of my senior year. Taking the timber structures course, which was one of my final courses, when you study wood design, you inevitably come up with the Forest Products Lab because of the wood handbook and as a basic, kind of a basic reference, and then we had some other texts. But when you learn, as soon as you get into anything timber engineering related, you're going to find that a lot of the basic references come back to the Forest Products Lab here. And so I'd heard about it, never really had visited it, until I was interested in the job interview. I came here in a job interview before I visited here on the, and I don't know when it was, probably in February, March, something like that. I came here, I'd have to find out for sure. But it was somewhere in the early part of the second semester of my senior year of college. I came here and met Fred. Remember Fred Warren took Nance and I on a tour, and we sat down with Fred and talked to him about it, and then we, Soon after that, I had the job offer.
Great. And what year was that?
1964.
Fabulous. So I guess from the your timber structures course, did you have any particular impressions of what the forest products lab would be once you came here? Or?
I don't really think I knew what I was getting into. I really didn't. And strangely enough, one of my weakest parts of my engineering, I think, was report writing. I dreaded it and stuff like that. And I'd had courses in report writing and stuff like that, so I knew the basics of it. But you soon found out you had an awful lot to learn. But now that in retrospect, that's really why you hire college graduates, is because they have ability to learn. They've proven an ability to learn. And so but that was probably one of my biggest struggles was, how do you write these reports and make them sound sensible, you know? And you could read other people's reports and they sounded so great, and then you tried to write like that, and pretty soon everything you wrote sounded so dull. And
yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I guess when you came here for the first time, what were your experiences? What was the first day like?
I don't remember. No thoughts of that. I know what my first paycheck was. First of all, I mean, the paycheck was going to be nearly a month away from by the time you started. It was two-week pay periods, and then it was sometime after that. And we were interested in that because, quite frankly, with just graduating from school and with a daughter and stuff like that, we were not very healthy financially wise. And I don't know how the word got out here some way, and somebody found out about it. And I don't know whether it was John Koning or Keith Kelly or something. I said, well, we've got the credit union here, and they would loan you money. So I think within the first week I was here, I went and got a loan from the credit union, mm-hmm. and probably paid it back. But and then I guess, you know, your first job, I was given. I worked with John Koning right away, and some with Bob Kurtnacker, and we were given some. We had some experiments to do with corrugated containers, and I worked with John. John was fairly new too at that time. John was always enthusiastic and always had lots of ideas, so we were always chasing some ideas.
So I guess going from that, could you describe a typical day, or was there a typical day?
I know one of the, well, I mean, it was 8 to 5 then. It was 8 o'clock, an hour lunch, 8 to 5. And then 10 to 15 minute coffee break at 10 o'clock and 3 o'clock. And in the packaging research, that was quite a ritual. Actually, there was, in addition to a lot of joking and stuff like that, it was kind of like a staff meeting, the coffee break. I mean, the guys would all get together, and in addition to, you know, a lot of other stuff, there was, you know, talk about what's going on and stuff like that. And so it was a mini staff meeting, the coffee breaks were. And the technicians and the engineers all got together, including the supervisor engineer, and it was kind of nobody really ran a meeting, but it was kind of like a meeting.
Interesting. How about some of the interesting projects that you worked on? What was maybe the most satisfying for you?
Over
the whole time.
Well, I think in the... The most satisfying thing for me was accumulation of things. We, when I started in the laminating research in 1967, I guess it was, there was a technical bulletin called Bulletin 1069. It was kind of the Bible of the laminating industry. It was a USDA technical bulletin by Alan Fries and Leonard Selbo. And that was the basic reference for everything that was done as far as engineering is concerned. As laminated timber. And that was, you know, published, I think, in 54. And so by 67, and then the research that we did over the next, I would say, 10 years, we found out that a lot of that needed to be supplemented, and the information that was in there, because the resource had changed. The experiments that were done back in the 40s, 30s and 40s, was all on pretty old growth material, a lot of it on Douglas fir. And the laminate industry was using both southern pine and Douglas fir, but mostly second growth material by that time. And there was different characteristics of the wood. And so the work that we did, I would say, we slowly developed supplemental information that had to go along with this Bullet 1069. And the way we put it all together was to write an ASTM standard. And I think probably the most satisfying thing for me was working over the years on that ASTM standard. And we finally got it to the point that it was adopted by ASTM. And then I think we immediately found out there needed to be lots of more changes on it. So the development of a national standard for procedures to develop engineering properties for laminate timber, I think, was probably what I enjoyed the most on it. In addition to working with the people, we had a pretty good relationship with the industry at that time, because they relied on the Forest Products Lab very heavily for their engineering data and for their development of standards and stuff like that. And so we worked closely with the Association of Laminating Manufacturers, which was called the American Institute of Timber Construction, or AITC. And there were some excellent people there to work with, and they were they came through and helped us a lot as far as providing research material and providing funding for travel when we didn't have funding and stuff like that. So, and we found that the research that we do, we were able to implement it pretty darn quickly through that association.
So you mentioned travel. Did you get to go anywhere interesting for your job, or spend any time anywhere else?
I guess over the first 25 years, I would say, we generally did, most of the researchers had one or two significant trips a year. Most of it domestic, but national type, either professional society meetings or standards meetings or something like that. You could generally get one or two trips a year in the budget. And then once I became project leader and got involved in more international stuff, then I actually made quite a few foreign trips. I was to Scandinavia, Norway, and Sweden, related to some research we did. I was to Australia, New Zealand, and I got the most travel I did. Let's see, where else? Oh, I visited Slovenia. We had a co-op project in Slovenia, Spain. I was to Portugal, Spain, on some national, these are some national meetings, either presenting papers or something like that. But, and then last 5 years I worked in the mid to late 90s, retired in 98. I would say over the last 5 years, we were involved with the Department of State international standards for wood products. And a lot of our trade at that time with wood products was with Japan. And like any country, Japan had an interest in protecting their own industry. And so their standards were written to protect their own industry, and yet our trade agreements with Japan said that they were supposed to harmonize these standards, so that you'd look at a U.S. standard, look at a Japanese standard, and say, well, let's bring these together some way. And the U.S. interest was, of course, to try to get the standards as near like ours as possible, so that a product produced here could be immediately adapted in Japan. And Japan, of course, the industry over there was interested in just the opposite. They wanted their own products to be to maintain their price structure and stuff like that. And at that time, our wood products could be imported. We could compete very well with their products at that time. And so it was very interesting. They wanted a technical expert on these engineered products in the trade negotiations. And so I probably made 8 or 10 trips to Japan, and with the state paid for it by the State Department, and a lot of those times I would sit in meetings, and sometimes I'd sit 2 days and never say a word. And the Japanese counterpart, they had a Japanese expert whom I knew, and we had met before and stuff like that, but
they just wanted the people there in case something came up. Mm-hmm. And very seldom did anything come up because it was mostly controlled from the political standpoint mm-hmm. rather than the technical standpoint. Mm-hmm. And you try to get some try to figure out how to get the technical part in there to support some of the political stuff. But it was interesting, and it was frustrating in some respect because you go over there for a while and it just wipes you out as far as the trip is concerned and stuff like that. I'll never forget the flying coach class. You can see by my size, coach class is not a very comfortable way to go. Mm-hmm. You know, a 13-hour trip or something like that, 13-hour flight. And I remember one time I woke up and you're crowded, this little Japanese woman had her head on my shoulder sleeping. So, and my knees, I have bad knees from football many years ago, and my knees would cramp up in there. And I talked to my doctor. I said, look, I get some different seats. Well, it's coach class only for U.S. government travel. And so I thought, there's got to be some way to do this. Well, if you have a doctor's excuse that you need, something like that. So I got my doctor to say that he needs more room when he travels because his legs cramp up. So I was able to use my miles to upgrade.
Oh, that's pretty good.
Well, nowadays, of course, they get to keep their miles. Oh. Back in those days, when you traveled with U.S. government and you earned miles, you had to use them for government travel. Hmm. I understand nowadays that's changed a little bit. But that's just a little trivia. Yeah.
So what came out of the Japan negotiations, or did that affect your work at all?
Not really. It didn't affect my work any. And I guess we were able to successfully develop some markets in the thing, but just like everything else, the yen versus the dollar mm-hmm. Changed so much over a period of years that there came to a point where the competitiveness was not nearly as great. I mean, we still export stuff to Japan, but it wasn't near as lucrative mm-hmm. Many years later, and I don't know where the standards sit today, but I know we were able to accomplish some changes in the standard, and they were we got them closer. You know, we thought we knew how to write the standard, and of course they thought they knew, and we tried to inform them on the background and some of this stuff. And but we were able to successfully do that. And for a time, there were several manufacturers in the U.S. who had a significant market in Japan, would export a lot of material to Japan. So I think we played some role in it. Mm-hmm.
Cool. So was your job political in any other sense?
Not really. No, I would say that was one of the nice things about here. It was we were pretty isolated from that. And I mean, industry always had an interest in, there was always industry interest. We would have meetings annually with advisors, a lot of them were industry people, and they were always trying to tell us what research we could do to make the product more competitive and stuff like that. But that was a minimal. You tried to do things that were, I mean, research. You want to do things that are eventually applicable, mm-hmm. and they were probably in a better position often to look at the short term market anyway and see what was applicable, but. But we had interest looking longer term. We say, well, that may help us the next year or two, but let's look at 10 to 20 years, where do we want to be? And we said, our role should be more in longer term stuff rather than solving the day-to-day industry problem.
Mm-hmm. And how was that reconciled with industry, or was it ever?
Well, I think we did a mix of things, but I think I like to believe that our mission was guided more by long-term stuff, mm-hmm. and we were. I mean, we would annually our advisory committees would make recommendations in certain areas, and they oftentimes these reports would be many pages long, and there would be maybe 20, 30 recommendations that may affect different things and stuff like that, and. And I remember each year we would, before the meeting, we would look at last year's reports and we would make a report on what we've done in answer to that.
And in some instances, I remember we said we decided that this is not an appropriate area to work on. That this should be it's an issue that should be more addressed by industry themselves or something like that. So, and I don't recall as those things ever became big political issues. We would do some things, and we would try to. One of our jobs was try to educate the industry people too on what some of these longer term research needs are.
Was there any particular project part of your job other than report writing that you found to be the biggest challenge?
Well, I guess the challenge, I didn't realize it, but once I became a supervisor, as a project leader, you were a supervisor, but you were also a lead researcher. And I would say the biggest challenge had to be the people aspects of work, trying to work with people and try to figure out what motivated them, and in some instances try to guide their research to some extent. But you still had, as a project leader, you were still responsible for you had to have a major research area of your own. You weren't just saying, I'm going to sit back here and watch all these other people go. You had to have a research area, plus you had to somewhat monitor what they were doing. If you had junior scientists, of course, that took more close supervision, I guess. The senior scientists, I had scientists that were roughly my own level and were in other areas that required minimal supervision. Mm-hmm.
And so did you have any training in management?
Oh, yeah. And that, I mean, you had all kinds of, I would say we had lots of opportunities for training in management. But management philosophies change too. You had you go for a 1 week or a 2 week management course, and they teach you one way to, you know, this is the way to do it, and then 5 years later there'd be a different theory on how to do it. So these were moving targets all the time.
Yeah. Did you have other opportunities for training in different areas? Or
yeah, I did take advantage of as far as technical is concerned. One of the reasons I came to the laboratory was to do some advanced work, advanced degree work, and I did. I worked a year at the lab, and then I pursued. I said I want to take some graduate courses at University of Wisconsin, and the lab said, "Okay, here's the deal. We'll adjust your work schedule so that it's not 8 to 5, but it's whatever your class is. We'll work around that. You make the time up in the evening or something mm-hmm. like that." And so I paid for my own coursework and still worked the 40-hour week for the first year. And I just took a course at a time. So I did that for a year or two, and then once I petitioned my supervisors, said, "Look, I'm doing fine in this. I'm doing great. Could you help me some?" And I think first, although they gave me some, they allowed me time to do it, mm-hmm. and then eventually it was paid for by the lab.
Yeah, well.
So I got my master's degree through a mixture of my own sponsorship plus lab sponsorship. So I got my master's degree. It took 5 years, a course at a time. And I'll never forget some of those courses. I'd go and after travel or something like that, you'd have to work these courses around that. And got home, there was a meeting or something like that. And I had to fly all night to get home. And got home and got to the lab and went to the class and came back. And I remember my secretary, she came to us and she said, "Russ, you really should go home. You're tired." I was just shocked. But I made it back for the class, and then I took the rest of the day off, I think.
Yeah. And in what department was it? Also in structural engineering?
Engineering mechanics, which is part of the engineering area. And then after, so I completed my master's degree in 1970. In the engineering mechanics is kind of theoretical structural engineering, which really complemented my bachelor's degree. And then I graduated in 1970, and then in 1979, I made a proposal to the lab. I said, "Look, I've been out of the structural engineering area 16 years now. Even though I took engineering mechanics, it was theoretical structural mechanics, not applied." I said, "I really should go back to school again for a while." And so I petitioned the lab to send me back to school. And I put together a package with Colorado State University. And that would get all my coursework for my PhD out of the way, but it was all applied to this, to structures. So I actually took a year off and moved to Fort Collins, Colorado from August of 79 to August of 80. Took the family out there, and I took a lot of credits for coursework. But in reality, we were working cooperatively with some of the Colorado State professors, and we had money out there doing cooperative work. And so, I mean, sure, I got time off, but I really worked with the professors out there on some of the jobs too. Mm-hmm. And so, and coursework, but it was a great experience as far as getting back in the swing of things. And I was obviously with students that were 20 years younger, mm-hmm. and who were fresh out of just having a master's or bachelor's degree, and it was a lot of tough competition, I'll tell you that. but we had a great experience, and so I did get all my coursework for the PhD out of the way, but I never did write the thesis. Mm-hmm. To finish up my PhD, so I'm not a PhD in engineering, but I have all the coursework, and I actually did partial thesis, I never regret it. It was a great experience, and I think we did accomplish a lot.
Mm-hmm. Great. I guess, are there any particular colleagues or people that you worked with that you have strong memories of, or any particular stories about?
Well, I don't see a lot of stories, I guess. One of the things that back in 1973, there was a group from the Forest Product Lab here, a group of guys in engineering that every spring would go on a fishing trip into the Boundary Water of Minnesota. And actually, they asked me in 1972 to do it, and they were doing it over Memorial Day, and we had other commitments. I couldn't do it. Then they asked me again in 73 if I'd be interested in going there. So certainly interested in going. I love fishing. I'm like, happy. So I went with this group, and practically everybody was at least 20 years older than me, I guess, 15 to 20 years older than me. And we went back and had a great time. I think there was five of us went that year, and it was It wasn't the Boundary Water Wilderness area then, it was the Boundary Water Canoe area, and you could actually use little motors on canoes. So we went back several hours by over portage and stuff like that. That only lasted about a few years. And actually, I went 73 the first time, mm-hmm. and I'm leaving this Wednesday for the 36th, because I went in 73, and if I go in 2008, it'll be my 36th trip back there.
Wow.
So we're planning to leave on Wednesday. So I've been able to take my son-in-law with me a few times. He's going again this year. And maybe someday even my grandson will go up there with me. But we've made some friends up there, and it's been a great trip. But that there's a lot of stories on the people from the lab from that trip. And I really can't pick out any of them. I think you've interviewed John Youngquist, mm-hmm. and his father was one of the ones that was the ringleader of that. And there's enough Wally Youngquist stories to write a book on. He's written some books on it, but it's there's a lot of great stories on that trip. And then Fred Warren was one of them. Alan Freeze. Alan was all the original group I went with had passed away now. I guess the group was more a social thing. It was not, fishing was not the main objective. In fact, most of them were not really good fishermen. They just loved to get out. They'd always catch fish. Mm-hmm. But it was a big social occasion, and the planning for it, the actual doing it, and then the talking about it afterwards was... Mm-hmm. So that was a fun part of it. See any other things? I guess what your question was. Was there any particular people or
stories?
Stories.
mean, we can come back to this.
Yeah. Well, I guess one of the things I'll remember forever that was when I was in packaging, probably within my first year of being here, we were in the building that's down, we used to call the root beer stands, the building that on the other side of the parking lot here. And it has, I think at that time it was all men in there. And there was a restroom. It was kind of a locker room restroom. And it had a stall in it. And I remember one morning, one of the older gentlemen that worked there came back down the hall and said, I think there's something wrong with one of the guys in there, because you could go in the room and the stall was locked, but there was room underneath you could see, and something's wrong, that person's been in there all morning. And so sure enough, somebody went in, you could see feet there, and hollered at him, no, not an answer. So finally the door was locked, of course. What do we do? Somebody cut down and crawled in. Well, somebody had put shoes there, put sticks down, put pants hanging down. We're pretty sure we knew who it was. And we're pretty sure it was Milo Shimming, because anything associated, you could always, of course, Milo would never admit to anything, but we're pretty sure he was behind that, because, but it was practical jokes being played and mm-hmm. stuff like that.
A lot of collegiality around here. A lot of friendships.
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's great.
And as far as, when I retired, a lot of people come back and volunteer and stuff like that. And I had enough other interests that I pretty much, when I retired, I pulled away. But I did get together once a month or so with a small group of people I used to work with. We have coffee.
Nice.
And talk about the old days and stuff like that.
So to sort of move to a different topic,
okay.
Generally, it's the Forest Products Lab is sort of jointly run or partly affiliated with the Forest Service and then also with the university. Did you feel more connected with either of those entities or the other?
Well, I guess our connection with the university was pretty loose in that although we did some cooperative work with some of the people at the university, I would say it probably wasn't as close a relationship as it probably could have been, I think. I think we could have done more things with the university. There was certainly graduate students did their theses here, and I actually supervised several of them. And I think we could have taken more advantage of that. There may have been ways to do it, but I guess the rewards were probably not. You didn't get rewarded for doing it or something like that. And it would have been nice. In retrospect, we had in the early 90s, I guess it was. We had quite a bit of money to do work on bridges. Timber bridges. And we had a strong effort in Washington to promote this and stuff like that. And one of the big promoters was Senator Byrd of West Virginia. And Senator Byrd was successful in getting a lot of the money that he rounded up earmarked for West Virginia. So it comes through here and headway to West Virginia. And we really struggled with that, because they knew they were going to get it. And so how do you control? How do you motivate them to do work that you want done and stuff like that, because they knew they were going to get it. So we tried to get some competition between the engineering and the forestry schools to break proposals on what to do and stuff like that. But if we just could have had the same type of thing with the University of Wisconsin here, if they would have said, look, here's the money, but you got to work with the University of Wisconsin on this, then there would have been some motivation. But in reality, the University of Wisconsin had to compete with everybody, all the other universities for funding. Mm-hmm. And certainly I got to know a lot of people in the engineering area, and we worked some with them. But I think we could have done a better job of working with them.
Mm-hmm. And how about with the Forest Service?
The Forest Service, we were, I mean, there was some other projects in the Forest Service that did some things roughly rated that we do, but they didn't have any strong engineering emphasis, I would say. Their engineering emphasis was peripheral. And so we really didn't do a lot. In my area, we didn't do a lot with other Forest Service research units. We were the main utilization laboratory for the Forest Service. And I mean, some of the other stations would have a unit that did some things with that. And we were at times we were encouraged to work with them, and at times we did. We did work with them. But again, the motivation, I guess, where was the motivation to do it? Because we really didn't have many peers at those locations that you could work with kind of one-on-one.
Mm-hmm. Well, sort of in the same vein then, what were your impressions of the Forest Service, I guess, before you came to work here and then as your job here?
Okay, I guess I really didn't have any impressions before I came here. I didn't really know what it was. And then, you know, slowly I learned that, yeah, we're part of the Forest Service, but we're part of the U.S. Department of Agriculture. But the mission of Forest Service seems to be so much different from the mission of many of the other USDA that the Forest Service kind of sits by itself as far as an agency. And then as far as our lab, we were, so much of the utilization research in the Forest Service was right here that there wasn't a whole lot for engineering to do with other stations. So, and as far as the Forest Service is concerned, we were continually, how should I say, the chief of the Forest Service always had big issues with utilization as far as harvesting is concerned. Mm-hmm. Well, I shouldn't say utilization. The big issue was timber harvest. We need to have sale quotas and all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And I guess my impression was that the timber industry in the South and the West, for a long time, pretty much ran the Forest Service timber sale policy. Mm-hmm. That was my impression. What used to happen is that these mills the little western towns, southern towns would have a lumber mill, and it would build up around a national forest sale or something like that. And then they said, well, we really need to, in order for our mill to be competitive, we gotta be 50% bigger. And so in order to get 50% bigger, we need more wood. And the way to get it was to get it from the Forest Service. Well, and if the Forest Service manager said, no, well, this is our sale, this is it, well, politicians got it. Politicians would say, look, you guys gotta come around here and get some more wood. So I think, in my mind, I have no direct evidence, but in my mind, the timber industry had a real influence on Forest Service timber sales in the South and the West for many years. Mm-hmm. And then by the coming into the 80s, more and more activists got involved, and then it went the other way, where all of a sudden we're setting aside more wilderness areas, which now comes that we take that out of the bank of potential harvest, and so that now a sustained harvest is, in order to sustainably harvest all this rest, you got to reduce that. And when that got reduced, mills had to shut down. And when mills shut down, all of a sudden there wasn't any way to utilize this now. So it was, it kind of, the pendulum, I think, swung one way and then it swung back the other way. And so the downshot of this was a lot of our, at least in the West, a lot of our small communities lost their timber industry because they had the feeling they had to be so big to be profitable, they became part of a bigger corporation or something like that, and they'd look at it and say, well, this little thing over here isn't getting us any money, so we'll shut it down. Mm-hmm. And so markets dried up in some of these areas, I've been retired 10 years now, but I know the struggle is still, how do we remove some of this material from the woods, because it's causing tremendous fire loads, and we got to figure out a way to get it out of there.
Yeah. Did you feel that any of the repercussions of sort of the political nature of the Forest Service here?
I don't know what. I suppose budget cuts are eventually what happened. The Forest Service became less of a contributor to the timber industry, and so I expect that they got less support for budget, which ended up being less support budget and utilization of one thing than they've got cut. So I think over the last 10 to 20 years, it has taken a cut. Because we had some great years for a while where budgets were increasing and staff was increasing and stuff like that. But I think this is all part of the pendulum where we were probably over harvesting the national forest at the chagrin of some of the forest managers. Mm-hmm. And they finally, I think there was finally a group within the Forest Service that just finally said, look, we can't put up with this anymore. And got enough environmental groups involved that it did make a change.
Yeah. So ultimately, did you see a change in the way the Forest Service was perceived?
I think so. Yes, definitely. The word, I guess the changing word was ecosystem management back in the, and that's probably 20 years old now, that word. And let's look at the whole system and how we can sustain the whole works. And this level of harvest that we've had in the past doesn't fit in with this. And so we ended up reducing timber cuts and sales and stuff like that.
I guess before we move into sort of post-forest products lab, were there any other projects that you worked on that you found particularly interesting that you wanted to mention?
Well, we had a research team on what's called PressLab, which was manufacturing square products from round timbers by peeling them and putting them back together. It was kind of like thicker veneer and making lumber-like products out of it. That was an interesting approach, and we pushed the limits to how thick you could peel and stuff like that. But lumber made that way is pretty standard now, and actually it was being done to some extent before then. But it was interesting working as part of a research team. We had different disciplines involved, and so a significant part of my time over 2-3 years was spent on that project. But it was interesting working with different people.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Great. All right, so sort of moving on into the end of your career, was there any particular reason why you chose to retire, or was it just time?
I had 34 years of service in. I had a year of sick leave, which gave me, and you could use your sick leave toward length of time of service. So I had 35 years, and when you start doing the calculations, you find that every year you work, you gain a little more, but you really don't gain that much. I had both of my daughters had graduated from school, were on their own. We owned quite a bit of property. I own, between partners and I, we have about 1,100 and some acres of mixed timberland and farmland out west, an hour west of here. And I found out that at that time, I was doing the forest management on the whole works, which is about 800 acres, over 800 acres of forest of work on. And I was doing that, and I love that. I love being out in the woods, doing some of it myself, working with loggers, consultants, stuff like that. I love to fish and love to hunt. And I've told the story many times. The last 5 years I worked, and if you analyze my time, you'll find that May, June and October were awful tough months for me to put a full day in the office. And knowing I had all this property out there that I love to be at, I have a cabin out there we built, and in the early 80s. We have, I have accommodations at one of the other places I can go and stay. So, and finally, my wife and I said, look, our kids are on their own. We got everything paid for. We just bought a bunch more property. About 5 years before that, we had all that paid for. And I looked at what my retirement income would be versus what we were actually doing. And I, even though I loved what I did, I had a great group to work with. It was just figured it was what was I going to gain by working a few more years? I talked to some people who were 5 to 10 years older than me who had retired, and they said, oh, why are you working? If you like, you know, if that's the only thing you had to do, then that's great. But I had a lot of other interests, so. And it's been an excellent move for me.
So do you still keep up with forest products research at all, or?
Not much. Not really very much. I get their newsletters, and I get to a retirement dinner once a year where they fill us in on what's going on. But it's, in 10 years, with the way staff reduction and stuff like that, there's not a whole lot of people I know anymore here. I haven't kept up that much on it, so. But I've got plenty of other things on the table.
And so do you feel like your work left a mark on the Forest Products Lab or on the Forest Service or on sort of the industry in general?
I think so. I said that the creation of that ASTM standard, I mean, ASTM or standards don't have authors per se, but I was very influential in the establishment of it, and we made modifications over the years. And I feel that a lot of the reports that I wrote do contribute to some of just that. So that was probably the most significant thing.
Mm-hmm. And so I guess we can come back to, you know, any other memories of people or stories or just memories of the lab that you want to record.
Let's see. What other thoughts do I have? Oh, I don't know. I guess, you know, certainly I think sometime before I retired, I made a list of all the people who had worked for me and where they were and what had happened and stuff like that. And I think even though some people worked here maybe only a short time and then had obviously better job offers other places, I feel in talking to them that their work experience here had an impact on their career. And then some of the students who went through here, we had students that worked for us part-time. We had some students who did thesis work here. And I always thought that was one of the rewarding things, was looking at how the lab and maybe myself had some influence on people's careers, and great to see some of them go on and be very successful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Did you enjoy working with the students?
Yes, I did. I did very much so, because they're it seemed that energetic, and they could. You'd mutually come up with some ideas on what way things should go, and. It seems that that things would go a lot faster with students than with staff, right? Because they were often motivated differently. They wanted to get that done and get their degree and get going.
Right. Whereas, mm-hmm. Hmm. That's interesting. I think we're getting close to an hour, so
okay.
If you have any other thoughts, otherwise.
Interesting. Now tell me, what's going to happen with this information? What do you do?